and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the documents from the Treasury Department's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, FinCEN, published by BuzzFeed News and the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists on Sunday, and speak with Will Fitzgibbon, a senior reporter at the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. His previous reports include Fatal Extraction, the Paradise Papers, and the Panama Papers, and he joins us to discuss the FinCEN files, which comprise 0.02% of the 12 million suspicious activities reports filed by FinCEN between 2011 and 2017. Major banks including JP Morgan Chase, HSBC, Barclays, and Deutsche Bank laundered dirty money with little oversight, and of the $2 trillion in suspicious transactions revealed, $1.2 trillion moved through Deutsche Bank. It is worth noting that this is the same bank whose records on Donald Trump's loans from Deutsche Bank, and who guaranteed them, has been at the heart of ongoing lawsuits to uncover what Trump has fought so hard to keep from the public. Unfortunately, enforcement lags so far behind criminality that, according to a 2011 report by the United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime, less than 1% of global illicit financial flows are seized and frozen. Then we'll speak with Mandy Smithberger, the director of the Center for Defense Information at the Project on Government Oversight, about how the Pentagon used taxpayer money meant for masks, swabs, and PPE to make jet engine parts, body armor, and dress uniforms. We will look into the skewed priority of what serves our public safety and national security with the nation under attack by a pandemic, as opposed to fattening defense contractors who have captured our government. Then finally, we'll examine the cultural genocide China is engaged in to subjugate the Uyghurs in a colonial program using sophisticated surveillance techniques in a mass incarceration of over one-tenth of the 11 million Uyghurs who undergo imprisonment, child abduction, forced sterilization, and forced marriages to Han Chinese. Sean Roberts, a professor of the practice of international affairs and the director of the George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs, joins us to discuss his new book, just out, The War on the Uyghurs, China's Internal Campaign Against a Muslim Minority. And before we go to our first guest, I want to thank you, our listeners and supporters, who have donated to sustain and build Background Briefing as the radio station we broadcast from closes down and we transition to online broadcasting, particularly during this pandemic. Your donations will help us improve our recording capabilities from home, so we encourage you to throw us a lifeline and join the fact-based community of listeners we are building around the globe with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. which helps keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to all those who are not in a position to contribute. And joining us now is Will Fitzgibbon, who's a senior reporter at the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, where he's also the Africa and Middle East Partnership Coordinator. His previous reports include the Fatal Extraction investigation that examined the impact of Australian mining companies in Africa, as well as the West African leaks, Paradise Papers and Panama Papers, and most recently, the FinCEN files. Welcome to Background Briefing, Will Fitzgibbon.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And the FinCEN files from the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network have exploded thanks to your organization's work. And it's nailed these big banks, JP Morgan Chase, HSBC, Barclays, and Deutsche Bank in particular. And the documents were published Sunday by BuzzFeed News and by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. And these FinCEN files are largely what they call SARs, right? Suspicious activity reports. Is that the bulk of what you have?
That's right. That's definitely the bulk of what we have. It's more than 2,000 of these suspicious activity reports. They are short and lengthy documents filed by U.S. banks to a very tight-lipped agency of the U.S. Treasury called FinCEN.
But these leaked documents that you've released represent only 0.2% of the total SARs reports. Apparently, you've seen, or reporters have seen, 2,100 leaked SARs reports, but there are 12 million SARs reports filed with FinCEN from 2011 to 2017. So
Well, I think that's one of the terrifying things about this. If you sit back for a moment and think that the FinCEN Files investigation has shown trillions of potentially dirty money moving around the world related to criminals, fraudsters, politicians, and scammers on every continent, and yet we're only talking about a few thousand of these documents. To think that there are millions of them that are shared with US and other government regulators each year really gives you a sense of how much dirty money is flowing through the financial system at any given time, and at the same time, how toothless so many of our national regulators are at stopping it.
Well, Deutsche Bank, of course, which is at the center of Donald Trump's efforts to cover up his financial transactions with Deutsche Banks, and the courts have been kind to him and delayed things till after the elections. And it does seem that he is quite determined not to have this information released about all of these loans that he got from Deutsche Bank. But in that context, in your report, Deutsche Bank again comes across as the number one villain. Of the $2 trillion in suspicious transactions, $1.2 trillion moved through Deutsche Bank.
It's certainly one of the biggest filers, if not the biggest filer, of these suspicious activity reports in the FinCEN files. That ranges from tens or hundreds of millions of dollars that Deutsche Bank helped move for a well-known Ukrainian tycoon who's perhaps best known for many, many years ago having or reportedly having armed goons burst into the office of a rival. But also, Deutsche Bank is helping despotic regimes such as Turkmenistan, middle of Central Asia, move $1.6 million for confectionery, of all things, to a shell company in London. And I don't think it takes a brain scientist or a rocket scientist to understand that a despotic government paying for confectionery to a shell company halfway across the world is perhaps not the cleanest money flow that can ever be seen.
And in other former Soviet states like Kazakhstan, you've got the family of Viktor Krupinov. He's mentioned Arkady Rotenberg, Putin's close friend, judo partner. He's mentioned, he showed up in the Panama Papers, didn't he?
He did. Roald Dugin, the famous billionaire cellist and childhood friend of President Vladimir Putin, has a tendency of appearing in more and more of these global cross-border investigations among journalists. And you're right, I think it's certainly true that former Soviet states, their citizens, their tycoons, their oligarchs are often appearing in these FinCEN files revelations. We put out a story yesterday around the world that looked at the abuse and rise of shell companies in the United Kingdom, for example, and how it is that tycoons from across former Soviet states have been flocking to these shell companies with registered offices in Cardiff, in Glasgow, or in the middle of nowhere in England. And instead of UK regulators paying any attention to who's behind them or asking why so much money is moving through them, kind of allow them just to sit on the corporate record books with very little scrutiny.
And again, I'm speaking with Will Fitzgibbon, a senior reporter at the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, where he's also the Africa and Middle East Partnership Coordinator. His previous reports include the fatal extraction investigation that examined the impact of Australian mining companies in Africa, as well as the West Africa leaks, Paradise Papers, and Panama Papers, and most recently, the FinCEN files. So let's talk a little bit about the influence of Russian oligarchs in the UK. Along with the work that your International Consortium of Investigative Journalists have done in releasing these FinCEN activities reports, suspicious activities reports, Panorama, the BBC investigative program, has also looked into the funding of the UK's ruling Conservative Party by oligarchs or wives of oligarchs linked to the Kremlin, in particular Vladimir Chernyukin, the husband of Lyubov Chernyukin, who's funneled about 7.8 million through offshore companies into the Conservative Party. Apparently, a lot of this money's coming from an oligarch, Suleyman Karimov. So it's interesting to notice. I mean, we know that there was Russian money behind the financing of Brexit itself. And it doesn't take, again, going back to your rocket science analogy, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to notice that Brexit has paralyzed the UK politically for years now and disrupted the EU. And the person who's most enjoying that, I'm sure, is Vladimir Putin. And he, through the FSB, funneled about $9 million into this insurance guy, Aaron Banks, who was the biggest donor to the Brexit campaign. So it seems that this pattern is continuing in the United Kingdom, to the extent that Russian money is buying British politicians of the ruling party, I might add.
Well, these suspicious activity reports, you're right, do seem to be yet more proof that money from individuals and companies closely associated to Putin, the Kremlin, is making its way into the United Kingdom and is making its way to individuals who have very close ties, maybe even tennis partners or exclusive dinner party buddies with leading UK figures. And that has been an important story in the UK, as you point out. Of course, recently there was a huge legal fight and political fight in the UK for the release of a government document, an inquiry that had looked into influence in British politics. So the FinCEN files, I think, come at an opportune moment to remind people yet again of these Russian financial ties in the United Kingdom. Let's remember that the FinCEN files documents are extremely confidential, top secret even, and there's no question that journalists were never intended to see these and report on these. So even if we might roll our eyes sometimes and say, we've heard all this before, you know, as a journalist, I think, and as members of the public, it's important that even if we think we know something, to have that ability to drill down into very minute level details about who's sending what, when, to whom, because ultimately it's with that knowledge that proper conversations and debates can take place.
Well, Secretary of Treasury Steve Mnuchin essentially controls FinCEN, does he not?
As Treasury Secretary, Mr. Mnuchin, yes, sits on top of the organisational structure, and FinCEN is an agency of Treasury. It's a pretty small agency, truth be told, and I think one of the debates that we've seen come out already in the United States, following, for example, statements by Senators Warren and Senator Bernie Sanders, is that quite simply the agency like FinCEN or its counterpart in Australia, AUSTRAC, probably don't have the teeth or the resources they need to help stop this money flow. I mean, if you think about it for a second, the FinCEN files was a global project that involved more than 400 journalists looking at these reports, whereas we understand that the overall staff of FinCEN, the US government agency, has around 300 employees, which I think really gives you a sense of just how up against it government authorities are if they don't have the people on the ground who can look into these very complicated financial transactions.
Well, Steve Mnuchin, of course, is the protege of Michael Milken, as is Leon Black and David Giovannis. David Giovannis is, of course, in Moscow, still working with the Kremlin, laundering their money through these oligarchs that Putin regulates. And there are these characters known in the trade as white boys, which are American lawyers and accountants, etc., coming out of big white shoe law firms, graduates of Harvard Business School and Wharton Business School. And they call them white boys because they essentially clean up the image of these dictators around the world with their ill-gotten gains, along with the Russian oligarchs like Deripaska, for example, who David Giovannis works for. So when you've revealed the connection in these FinCEN revelations of how the Russians are financing British conservative politicians, is there any clues here to whether the Russians are financing American politicians?
Well, what I would say about the FinCEN files is that at least part of the reason why we have these documents and why BuzzFeed News obtained them in the first place is all tied up in the investigation of Paul Manafort, President Donald J. Trump's former campaign manager. We know that some of these suspicious activity reports were requested by the U.S. Congress during investigations into Russian meddling in the U.S. election. So while all of the stories from FinCEN files speak to countries around the world, it's true that part of the original heart of the FinCEN files documents and why they were created does lie in in this now long-standing narrative of Russian interference in the US elections, indeed. And to go to the point that you were making earlier, I've kind of done this reporting for long enough now to realize that behind every Russian or Ukrainian tycoon is a London or New York lawyer or professional reputation management specialist in a crisp suit.
Well, that's what they call the white boys, right?
Exactly.
So just in closing, though, in the big picture, because the world is awash with dirty money, criminal money, kleptocratic money stolen from the people in these desperately poor countries, along with drug money. And the percentages, according to a 2011 report by the United Nations Office of Drug and Crime, estimated that less than 1% of global illicit financial flows were seized and frozen. So is that your understanding of the ratio between how much money is sloshing about in the Ethernet and in these offshore fronts and all of these shell companies? Is that about the ratio of the level of justice we have here?
We certainly understand that to be true. We tried very hard, as you could imagine, to try and update those figures from 2011. And everyone we spoke to, every expert we spoke to, had nothing to say that made us think those figures were any different today. And indeed, the experts we did speak to, including some of the leading global financial anti-money laundering agencies, agreed with those kind of top-line figures and also said that when it comes to the efforts of national anti-money laundering agencies around the world, in the quotes of one senior figure, all of those agencies are failing. So we've got that double punch, if you like, of trillions and trillions of dirty dollars in dirty money flowing around the world, and the overt recognition by anyone who pays attention to this that the crime fighters who are meant to be clamping down on this don't have the resources or the ability to do so.
But just in closing, is this because the dirty money is commingled with corporate money and the money of wealthy individuals that are hiding their money from the tax man? And that leads to another issue, is the extent to which there is growing inequality and the fact that the rich are getting all of these tax breaks and not paying their taxes. And many of them are not paying any taxes because they hide their money abroad. And that money is commingled with dirty money, and they have the political protection not to go after their money. Therefore, the dirty money is not investigated. Is that the situation?
I do think that the FinCEN Files investigation shows, and experts we speak to do say, that the broken anti-money laundering system around the world is another consequence and contributor to this global inequality that we see. You know, I cannot count the number of times where I've had my own personal bank block my credit card, send me an email, or have someone call me up on the phone and say that they're not processing a transaction because, you know, I'm on holiday in a different country that they don't recognize. And yet when I, as a journalist, see that someone who 10 years ago was accused of fraud or money laundering, and yet they're allowed to send $150 million through a shell company in the British Virgin Islands, it really does make you wonder whether there is one set of rules for your average Joe and Jane and another set of rules for anyone who's got a wad of dollar bills in their back pocket that's big enough to say, help pay some bank fees to Main Street banks.
Well, Will Fitzgibbon, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Will Fitzgibbon, who's a senior reporter at the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, where he's also the Africa and Middle East Partnership Coordinator. His previous reports include the Fatal Extraction Investigation that examined the impact of Australian mining companies in Africa, as well as the West Africa Leaks, Paradise Papers and Panama Papers, and most recently, the FinCEN Files. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into how the Pentagon has used taxpayer money meant for masks, swabs, and PPE to make jet engine parts, body armor, and dress uniforms. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mandy Smithberger, who's the director of the Center for Defense Information at the Project on Government Oversight. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mandy Smithberger.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And you're quoted in the Washington Post in a story, Pentagon used taxpayer money meant for masks and swabs to make jet engine parts and body armor. Shortly after Congress passed the CARES Act, the Pentagon began directing pandemic-related money to defense contractors. And you're quoted as saying, this is part and parcel of whether we have budget priorities that actually serve our public safety and whether we have a government that is captured by special interests. So there are, of course, clear and present dangers coming from the pandemic affecting our military readiness, aren't there? So why would they not make that a priority and divert money to defense contractors?
That's a good question. So Congress appropriated this money assuming that it was going to be used to help with enhancing PPE and helping to protect, you know, just ordinary Americans as well as defense employees that were being made to go into work. And instead, what you saw happen was that the Pentagon used this as a slush fund for defense industrial base priorities and handouts for defense contractors, that it was clear that's not where Congress wanted this money to go.
But we've learned fairly early on in the pandemic that it was affecting aircraft carriers deployed around the world because they're sort of a floating petri dish, you know, what, with 5,000 people aboard or something like that. And I don't know, have you learned anything more about what the Navy did to prevent the spread of coronavirus aboard these big nuclear aircraft carriers?
So I think what we've seen is that largely the response of the Navy and other parts of the military was slow and inadequate, that they weren't doing enough to acquire PPE equipment, that in some of these cases, people have been forced to stay on these ships and been at significant increased exposure and risk. So I think in a number of ways it's been inadequate, but it wasn't an issue of whether there was enough money. It was about problems with the supply chain and making sure that this equipment could get to where it was needed. So that's what makes it even more troubling that the department wasn't using these funds that Congress had given them to be able to secure more of this equipment to keep everyone on these ships safe.
So the supply chain might involve getting PPE from China, right?
Correct.
And that's not a...
Or anywhere else you can get it.
Right. But that's not a very secure position for the Pentagon to be in, having to rely on China.
Correct. And one of the things that Congress had done is they were providing this money under the Defense Production Act, which is intended to be able to give the government enhanced capacity to enhance production in areas where the market might not be meeting those needs. So again, it's unfortunate that the department did not use that authority to help with that shortfall for the most part.
Well, already we're learning from Robert Redfield, the director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. He, in Senate testimony last week, he said that just domestically, the states desperately need $6 billion to distribute vaccines, Americans, which are expected early next year. And U.S. hospitals, many of them face severe shortages of N95 masks. So we're kind of, it's like Groundhog Day, isn't it? We're back to where we were in the beginning of the pandemic. It's just amazing. What does it say about our industrial base? You know, is it so skewed to making jet engine parts and other stuff that we simply can't do simple stuff anymore, like PPE?
Yeah, I think what it really says is that we have a Department of Defense that is largely captured by large defense contractors, and that they kind of just want to keep on continuing to build and do what they always do, and that they haven't really fully understand the scope of the pandemic and the needs there and the need to adjust priorities based on that. So unfortunately, I think it's shown that the department is not very agile and not very responsive to current threats.
And again, I'm speaking with Mandy Smithberger, who is the director of the Center for Defense Information at the Project on Government Oversight. And we're talking about how the Pentagon diverted money meant for PPE protection for the military and for civilian use to award $183 million to firms including Rolls-Royce and ArcelorMittal, to maintain the shipbuilding industry, tens of millions of dollars for satellites, drones, and space surveillance technology, $80 million to a Kansas aircraft parts business suffering from the Boeing 737 MAX grounding, and the global slowdown of air travel, and $2 million for a domestic manufacturer of army dress uniform fabric. So that's the priorities. Can you pin this on the Secretary of Defense? Esper, who's apparently known within the Pentagon as Yesper, he's a former executive with Raytheon, isn't it?
Yes, he was a lobbyist for Raytheon before he became Secretary of the Army and then Secretary of Defense. I think you do have to look at the leadership, both in the Secretary of Defense and Ellen Lord, who is the head of acquisition and used to be an executive at Textron, that I think you've seen an over too much coziness with the defense industry, that Ellen Lord, at the beginning of this crisis, said that she was on the phone with the defense industry daily, hearing what their needs were. And you didn't have members of our military or civilians having that kind of access about what they needed to be able to continue to do their jobs.
Well, I don't know whether it goes above Esper to Trump himself. I mean, we know Trump has referred to the soldiers, particularly those that have died in battle for the wars that America's fought, going back to World War One in particular, when he boycotted a ceremony to honor the American fallen in 1917. He referred to them as losers and suckers, and he's been going out of his way to try and undo that damage. But his excuse whenever he's confronted with his attitudes towards the men and women in uniform and those who've died for this country, he always cites how much money he's giving the Pentagon. So is that working? Do you have any kind of the pulse of the rank and file here? Do you know what's going on with them? Do they realize that this guy doesn't care about the boys, he only cares about the toys?
I think it's unclear. I think that you've seen recent polling from Military Times that there is less support for the president in the military than he was assuming. Certainly those comments are atrocious and I think have created a lot of additional concerns. It would be remiss in not pointing out, you know, he also said that he thinks senior Pentagon officials are too cozy with the defense industry and that that's prevented his efforts to extract U.S. troops from our endless wars. So certainly he's kind of speaking out of both sides of his mouth with those comments when he's continuing to push for larger and larger Pentagon budgets. But I don't think you're seeing that increased spending making us safer. I think you're buying, you know, more toys, that you're actually hollowing out the force and that it's undermining our security and safety.
But apparently it wasn't just the CARES Act that was raided by the Pentagon and to give to the contractors. Apparently also under the Paycheck Protection Program, defense contractors were getting money. Have you done any auditing on that?
I've done less work on that program. But yes, there have been a number of funds made available. And there was recently a Government Accountability Office report too that pointed out that while the Department of Defense keeps on claiming that they need more money to cover contractor costs, other federal agencies have found ways to cover those costs within their budget. So I think you're seeing, again, completely different attitudes towards accountability and fiscal responsibility.
Well, according to the Washington Post article, government data shows that at least 10 of the approximately 30 companies known to have received the Defense Department's DPA funds also received loans through the Paycheck Protection Program. So they were getting it coming and going.
Absolutely.
So is this just another case, though, of the longstanding situation in this country where the Pentagon just gets a blank check and that the Congress, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, just go along with it? It's extraordinary, particularly when you have a real crisis like the pandemic, which is hurting this country. And that's the priority, the number one priority of the president, to protect and defend the country, as is the oath that all of these people in the Pentagon who are serving to protect the country swear to. And yet the main threat that this country faced is not being dealt with. I just find that amazing. Do you have any idea why it is that we're buying jet engine parts when we got plenty of jets in the military, but we're going nowhere in defending ourselves against the pandemic?
I think it's that we do have a broken system that has put the profits of defense contractors over the safety of the American people for years. I think you're starting to see some members of Congress question that status quo when you have both the Senate and the House having votes on whether to cut the Pentagon's budget by 10%. While those amendments didn't pass, they received significantly more support than we've seen in the past for those kinds of measures. So I think you're increasingly seeing, as there's more frustration with these endless wars, as we have this global pandemic occurring, that our current Pentagon spending priorities are not serving the American people.
But from your dealings with the Pentagon, do they recognize the pandemic as a clear and present danger that the United States is not under attack by a foreign enemy so much as a microscopic virus, but it's still damaging this country?
I think they're grossly underestimating the consequences of the pandemic, that they're treating this as some kind of nuisance, and that, they can just continue to focus on competition with China, competition with Russia, trying to continue to build up their budgets and not understanding the world as it is and how the world has changed.
So, do you get any sense then of what's going to change their minds? Because obviously, the president, and he is, of course, the commander in chief, he's trying to downplay the COVID pandemic. In fact, he's more or less telling his supporters that it's all over, forget about it. And we're just passing the 200,000th death in this country. So, is that affecting the Pentagon's attitude that they're following the commander in chief's lead of ignoring the pandemic or declaring it over?
I think the president's lack of leadership on this issue is certainly feeding down to the Pentagon. But I've, consistently actually been shocked at just how out of touch they are with what's happening, how quickly they moved to make sure that employees would be called essential infrastructure so they had to continue to go into work. You had defense contractor employees who were frustrated that they were having to go into work to support foreign arms sales. It would be one thing to support U.S. equipment and our military, but why are they risking their lives to be able to help arms sales for other countries? So I think short of a significant budget cut or significant electoral consequences, I don't know that the Pentagon is going to understand just how misguided and how much they've lost their way.
So, just in the last couple of minutes, let's talk about the significant changes that might happen if Biden is elected. Is there any sense from you there as a watchdog in Washington that things are going to change?
I don't think we're going to see significantly different changes in this arena from the Biden administration. The senior or the advisors he's relying on largely come from the defense industry as well. You see them echoing very similar rhetoric on the need to prioritize defense spending. Now, there's going to be a major opportunity. For the past 10 years, we've had a Budget Control Act that's put nominal caps on Pentagon and, domestic spending. And that expires in 2021. So there's an opportunity to renegotiate what our overall budget priorities are going to look like. But I think unless you see a significantly different Congress or more public engagement, that we're not going to see things change that much under a Biden administration.
Well, you've got states going broke. You've got the underfunding of PPE, and we're sort of back to zero when we started with this pandemic, and it's hardly made a difference, which is just extraordinary. And there's a real potential for this virus to cripple our economy maybe for a year or two. And that is an issue of national security, is it not? So there's a disconnect here that I'm just scratching my head over.
Yeah, it is a strange disconnect that it's hard to understand or explain. So it might be that what happens to our economy means that it doesn't really matter what senior Pentagon officials want. We just don't have the resources to be able to continue to fund these endless budgets. But, it remains to be seen.
Well, it remains to be seen whether we're going to have a national guns and butter debate, doesn't it? The idea that you've got defense contractors risking their lives to build arms for foreign sales is pretty extraordinary. But just in general, you'd think that this has been a problem for decades, has it? That the guns and butter argument just doesn't go anywhere. They give the Pentagon a blank check and only a few voices talk about how we need to start investing in America itself. You know, in other words, we could lose the republic in order to maintain the empire.
Yeah, I think unfortunately we've too often looked at the Department of Defense to solve every problem that we have. And not only are we asking them to make guns, we're asking them to make butter. And the idea that they would be leading our pandemic response just because they have the most resources and not because they have the most expertise, these are all ways that we are not addressing our country's largest problems in the most effective way that we can. I think you're seeing some additional appetite for the guns versus butter debate, particularly on the need to strengthen our infrastructure and our ability to combat climate change. But I think it's, still something that we haven't seen widespread support for really having that debate.
Well, it's Mandy Smith-Berger, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you again for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Mandy Smith-Berger, who's the director of the Center for Defense Information at the Project on Government Oversight. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the cultural genocide China is engaged in to subjugate the Uyghurs in a colonial program using sophisticated surveillance techniques in a mass incarceration of over one-tenth of the 11 million Uyghurs.
He fastened all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Sean Roberts, who's a professor of the practice of international affairs and director of the International Development Studies Program at George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs. He's the author of the new book just out, The War on the Uyghurs, China's Internal Campaign Against a Muslim Minority. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sean Roberts.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And it's really extraordinary to think that this outrageous, well, it's not genocide, but it is, when you think about Myanmar and Tibet, it's certainly up there in terms of an international outrage. Yet, fortunately, your book is exposing it. But by and large, it doesn't seem to be getting the attention it should. And I guess that's to do with China's economic clout. And it doesn't help, of course, that our own president basically told Xi Jinping that he thought it was a good idea to put Uyghurs in concentration camps. So from all the work that you've done after 3 decades of studying the Uyghurs and you speak their language, what's your explanation for why there's not more international outrage?
Well, I think, for one thing, you could say that the international community in general is not very good at handling mass atrocities. But I do think that since the advent of the global war on terror following 9/11, atrocities against Muslim populations, and particularly marginalized Muslim populations, have really been immune to international response. And there's, multiple reasons for that. One is that arguably the United States is itself guilty of mass abuses of human rights in its war against terrorism. And then another part of it is that, you know, this war on terror, which we're practically two decades into, does not have any international consensus about what constitutes a terrorist and what is terrorism. So that has allowed kind of a wide open ability for a variety of states to target Muslim marginalized populations as terrorists without having to really show that that is a legitimate accusation against them, because there is no definition of what a terrorist is.
So given that the September 11th attacks and the war on terror have given the Chinese cover for what they're doing against the Uyghurs, what then is the Chinese government's excuse? They've implicated the Uyghurs in the global war on terror, as your book makes clear, but they've done it without any evidence. So how is this pure paranoia?
You know, I think it's always difficult to look into. Well, it's difficult to anthropomorphize states and assume that they make decisions unilaterally. I mean, one of the things I argue in my book is that really what the Chinese state is doing to the Uyghur people has more to do with settler colonialism. You know, this is a region inside of China that's, you know, arguably been a constituent part of modern China since the late 19th century, at least. But China had never really integrated it into its vision for a modern China. And, you know, this is due to a bunch of different reasons, one of them being just kind of a lack of capacity on the part of the state for much of that time. But now we really see an attempt to integrate this region. And, you know, it differs very little from other examples that we've seen historically of state powers that have tried to integrate areas that belong to indigenous populations. We can look at the west of the United States. We can look at places like Australia, various parts of Latin America. And we've seen that the way that modern states integrate these regions is really, it really is a type of genocide. I call it in my book cultural genocide, because the aim is to marginalize this population, displace it from its homeland, and be able to develop that homeland and settle the majority population there and make it kind of a generic part of the modern state. And I think that's the real motivation for what China is doing to the Uyghurs. However, you know, they've framed it continually in terms of counterterrorism. And I think to the point where there's certainly probably parts of the state implementing policy who believe that is really the reason that this policy is being implemented.
And again, I'm speaking with Sean Roberts, who's a professor of the practice of international affairs and director of the International Development Studies Program at George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs. He's the author of the new book just out, The War on the Uyghurs, China's Internal Campaign Against a Muslim Minority. So this then is not that different from the colonial attitude that the Chinese have, the Han Chinese have towards Tibet, where they built a railway all the way up there and they've started to settle Han Chinese and expunge and extinguish a Tibetan culture and their worship of the Dalai Lama, etc. They've been pretty successful. And, you know, Han Chinese will argue, well, we're just bringing them modernity. You know, what are they complaining about? Is that the same attitude they have towards the Uyghurs?
Absolutely. You know, there was a white paper that came out this week from the Chinese government that was basically saying just that. You know, and this is for those who have studied the history of colonialism, that is the classic excuse. I mean, I think I learned a similar excuse for why the United States had wars against Native Americans and subjected them to a lot of atrocities. I think that, you know, it is interesting to look at the Uyghur issue as very similar to the Tibetan issue. And I think the one difference, you see, is because Uyghurs are Muslim, that has allowed the state to be much more violent in the way that it's forcibly assimilating people and displacing them and marginalizing them. Because there is precedent globally for doing that in the name of counterterrorism. Whereas while there's precedent for doing it just in terms of modernization, that's no longer really tolerated the way it was in the 19th century. You know, now people are more sensitive to that issue that, you know, different cultures are not necessarily anti-modern. Different cultures are part of modernity as well.
Well, obviously, as your book makes clear, that China is using the US-led war on terror to erase the cultural identity of its Muslim minority in Xinjiang province. And there are 11 million Uyghurs living in China today, and literally a tenth of that population are in concentration camps or re-education camps. And this is just extraordinary. There are reports of forced sterilization of women, forced marriages of Uyghur women to Han Chinese men, and nearly 500,000 children have been placed in orphanages, in spite of the fact that their parents are still alive. And they, of course, the children are subject to political and cultural indoctrination. Are all of those reports true?
I mean, it's difficult to know the exact numbers, but it's certainly true that all of these things are happening, and the scale of it is definitely significant. We don't know exact numbers, primarily because the Chinese government doesn't release exact numbers on these things. But what we see is really, I think, a network of policies that are aimed at destroying the Uyghur community as we know it and the Uyghur identity. And the mass internment camps are certainly the most headline-grabbing part of that. But largely that, I think, is meant to enforce compliance from the Uyghur population as a whole. So I think the two things that you may have, you know, listeners may have heard about in the media are these mass internment camps and a mass network of electronic surveillance. And those two things taken together basically allow the Chinese government to punish any Uyghur who's not compliant to other policies that are going on. And those other policies include mass labor programs that are displacing Uyghurs from their home villages and putting them in residential factory settings, and then putting their children in residential schools from kindergarten on up. And this essentially is breaking down the social fabric of the Uyghur population. And at the same time, the Chinese government's transforming the landscape of the Uyghur homeland so that, you know, that it won't be recognizable as being a specifically Uyghur region. Except in little pockets that might be conducive to tourism. So I think that, you know, regardless of the numbers, which sometimes the Chinese state comes back and argues about numbers in these institutions and so on, what's more important to understand is the mass scale of what's happening and the fact that the most egregious parts of it are meant to make sure that the entire population follows the policies that the state implements without any sort of resistance.
But under Xi Jinping, who has definitely rolled back reforms and freedoms in China and has a very militarized foreign policy and has this Belt and Road Initiative that goes right across the area where the Uyghurs live all the way down to Pakistan, and that is one of his big sort of vanity projects. So does that put the Uyghurs more in the crosshairs?
I think it does. I make the argument in my book that in some ways the Belt and Road Initiative, you know, which is a more recent history, is part of a process that's been ongoing since the 1990s. You know, in previously, before the reforms of Deng Xiaoping, the Chinese government looked at these frontier regions very much as a buffer zone to keep out external influences. But after the economic reforms started to go into place in the 1980s and 1990s, increasingly these frontier regions were important parts of the Chinese economy, and they were essentially land ports or seaports, depending on which frontier, that would lead to all kinds of economic opportunity in terms of external trade, which, you know, we all know that the Chinese state's economy is very much based on import, export, and international trade. So I think this has been a process, but certainly, you know, maybe the reason that the situation became drastically worse in 2017 was that in part there was a real imperative to make the Belt and Road Initiative become a reality, and a key part of that was ensuring that there was no resistance to mass development in the Uyghur region. So, you know, I think that it was kind of a boiling point where Xi Jinping said, okay, enough. We don't want to see any more resistance from this region. This region is very important to my signature project, and we have to get everything under control. And that's been, you know, the situation over the last 3 years.
So back to my original question about the lack of international pressure on the Chinese, and of course undercut by our own president, who is now, of course, using China as a whipping boy in his re-election campaign, but in private conversations with Xi Jinping, asking him for favors to help him get re-elected, and also pandering to Xi Jinping by saying he supports what he's doing to the Uyghurs, which is extraordinary for an American president. Of course, he is similarly hung out to dry the Hong Kong pro-democracy activists as well. So what's likely to happen with the Myanmar-based lawsuit, which British lawyers who represent two Uyghur organizations have filed with the International Criminal Court this year against the Chinese government? And the basis of their claim is that their clients were forcibly deported from ICC member states, meaning Cambodia and Tajikistan, where apparently a number of Uyghurs have been literally deported back to China, where they were interned in concentration camps.
Yeah, you know, I think going back to your original question about the lack of international response and the power of the Chinese government internationally, you know, this is a significant problem. The International Criminal Court is notoriously less effective the stronger the government is that is being taken to court on. You know, the United States has notoriously kind of thumbed its nose towards the International Criminal Court. And I imagine that the Chinese government will do something similar. That said, I do think it's really important that there are these international initiatives, and particularly ones that are not just U.S.-centric. The problem, of course, which you alluded to, is right now the U.S. government does not have, I think, the most authority globally on human rights issues and on any number of issues. I think that the Trump administration has spoken out about the situation of the Uyghurs. There is new legislation that was adopted, the Uyghur Human Rights Protection Act. And although I welcome those moves by the U.S., what I've been seeing recently is the Chinese government is able to kind of deflect this criticism by saying, well, this is just part of the new U.S. Cold War against China. And so it's really important to internationalize this beyond the United States. And so I think I really welcome this attempt by British lawyers who, one, are not emanating from the U.S., and two, are taking a very evidence-based and legal approach to this issue. And I do worry that international mechanisms like this have generally not been able to stop mass atrocities. In some instances, they've at least been able to bring justice retrospectively. And I think this is important. But the other thing I think that's really important is that grassroots activists get involved in this issue. And it really shouldn't be a geopolitical issue. I've seen, as of late, some grassroots activists in the United States have denied that anything egregious is happening to Uyghurs inside China, basically because they see it through the spectrum of the Trump administration's attacks on China. But this should not be a geopolitical issue. This should be a humanitarian issue. And people who believe in human rights, social justice, racial justice, you know, should be concerned about this issue and the precedent it sets globally. And I do think that grassroots activists can have an impact through consumer advocacy, you know, which is something that has become more effective in recent years, I think, with the help of social media. You know, if people can target companies that are complicit in what's happening to the Uyghurs, I think these companies will react. And we saw this just, I think, last week. H&M, the clothing retailer, cut its connections with a factory in the Uyghur region that had been accused of involving forced Uyghur labor in its supply chain. And that was a pretty rapid response. And I think that, you know, the more pressure that can be put on companies to put economic pressure on their Chinese partners, I think that could be a very important leverage point. Because on the one hand, China's power internationally is due to its economic reach. So on the other hand, if that's what is targeted in terms of fighting back against what's happening to the Uyghurs, that may have more influence on Beijing than even international declarations or legislation passed in the U.S. Congress.
Well, Sean Roberts, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Sean Roberts, who's a professor of the practice of international affairs and director of the International Development Studies Program at the George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs. He's the author of the new book just out, The War on the Uyghurs, China's Internal Campaign Against a Muslim Minority. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. To help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate free, we have added a donate button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man she loves.